This conversation on COVID-19 is made possible by Discovery.
Welcome to Inside COVID-19. I'm Jackie Cameron for BizNews. Around 65% of people with coronavirus lose their sense of smell and taste, and it's estimated that about 10% of those go on to develop rare conditions that create havoc. Parosmia means you can find human waste smells like food, and vice versa. So what causes parosmia? We spoke to Reading University flavor scientist Dr. Jane Parker, who is undertaking in-depth research on long COVID and parosmia. Also coming up in this program, the long-term effects of COVID-19 on the travel and tourism industries, with warnings that life may only return to normal in 7 years at today's vaccine rates. We hear from Christopher Nassetta, President and CEO of Hilton Hotels, about the outlook for the hotel industry in 2021. First, the COVID-19 headlines.
Inside COVID-19 from BizNews.
More than 104.9 million people are now reported as having tested positive for COVID-19 around the globe. About 2.3 million people have died of the disease. More than 119 million vaccine shots have been given worldwide. In South Africa, just under 45,500 people are reported as having died of COVID-19, while there have been 1.5 million positive tests reported by the government. When will life return to normal? In 7 years at today's vaccine rates, says Bloomberg. The news organization has built the biggest database of COVID-19 shots given around the world. U.S. science officials such as Anthony Fauci have suggested it will take 70% to 85% coverage of the population for things to return to normal. Bloomberg's vaccine tracker shows that some countries are making far more rapid progress than others, using 75% coverage with a two-dose vaccine as a target. Israel is the country with the highest vaccination rate in the world, and it is headed for 75% coverage in just 2 months. The U.S., says Bloomberg, will get there just in time to ring in the 2022 new year. However, this pace is likely to accelerate further as more vaccines become available. Some of the world's biggest vaccine manufacturing hubs in India and Mexico are only just getting started. A new vaccine by Johnson & Johnson recently showed positive results using a single dose in a large clinical trial. If approved, there will be an adjustment to the number of doses required proportionate to its market share in each country. Russian vaccine developers are in discussions with China's CanSino Biologics to test a combination of their shots aimed at a better result. Italy is planning to begin its vaccination campaign for people under 55 on Tuesday. The first doses from AstraZeneca are due to arrive at the weekend. Poland will reopen hotels, cinemas, theatres and operas at up to 50% capacity for a 2-week trial period starting on February the 12th. The reopening will include outdoor sport facilities such as ski slopes and tennis courts, but restaurants and fitness clubs will remain closed. Using patient data, artificial intelligence can make a 90% accurate assessment of whether a person will die from COVID-19 or not. That's according to new research at the University of Copenhagen. Body mass index, gender, and high blood pressure are among the most heavily weighted factors. The research can be used to predict the number of patients in hospitals who will need a respirator and determine who ought to be first in line for a vaccination. China quelled the coronavirus by deploying its authoritarian system to get things done. But 7 weeks into China's vaccination campaign, the picture is surprisingly underwhelming. The more than 31.2 million doses administered since its official start on December the 15th have put it second only to the U.S. with its nearly 35 million shots. Yet, for a population of 1.4 billion, China has delivered little more than 2 doses for every 100 people. Compare this to 3 in the European Union, 10 in the U.S. and nearly 60 in Israel. French authorities say it's not possible to ease COVID-19 restrictions yet, but the situation doesn't justify imposing a fresh lockdown. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said in an interview that it's still too soon to ease the lockdown in Europe's largest economy. This is even as the pandemic shows signs of ebbing. Until vaccines are widely available, weekly COVID-19 testing plus a 2-week isolation period for positive cases may be the most cost-effective strategy to tackle the spread of the virus in the U.S. This is according to a study in The Lancet. Ursula von der Leyen says she underestimated the complications that can arise in the production of coronavirus vaccines. This is according to the Süddeutsche Zeitung, which cites an interview with the European Commission president, saying, "We focused very much on the development of a vaccine. In retrospect, we should have thought more about the challenges of mass production in parallel." The Philippines will make it mandatory to wear masks inside all vehicles, even for passengers from the same household. A UK variant of COVID-19 has been found in Melbourne before the Australian Open. More than 500 members of the Australian Open tennis cohort received negative COVID-19 test results on Friday after a quarantine hotel worker contracted the virus. Host city Melbourne had all but eliminated the virus until a local case of the B.1.1.7 variant was detected in a worker at a hotel where players quarantined. India is set to receive the largest number of COVID-19 vaccine doses, 97.2 million shots, in the first tranche of the distribution from the World Health Organization's COVAX initiative. This is despite the fact that the supply in the country is outstripping demand. The COVAX initiative, aimed at creating equitable global access to COVID vaccines, especially for developing countries, is planning to distribute about 338 million doses at the end of this month. The large allocation to India is likely to raise eyebrows, given that the country currently seems to have plenty of shots, but few takers. Only around half of those eligible to get vaccination in its inoculation drive have come forward, and local media reports say that India producer Serum Institute of India is sitting on over 55 million doses and has temporarily halted production. The UK will require travellers from coronavirus hotspots to quarantine starting on February the 15th. Arrivals from countries on the UK's travel ban list, which include countries in southern Africa, will be required to isolate for 10 days in government-approved accommodation. China donated 200,000 doses of coronavirus vaccines to Zimbabwe, which will help kickstart the government's rollout of inoculations, according to President Emmerson Mnangagwa. COVID-19 vaccines, which have been scientifically ascertained to be safe, will soon be introduced, he said in a televised address. He promised that these will be state-funded and free.
Inside COVID-19 from BizNews.
Many people with COVID-19 temporarily lose their sense of smell. As they recover, it usually returns, but some are finding that things smell different, and things that should smell nice, such as food, soap, and their loved ones, smell repulsive. The numbers with this condition, known as parosmia, are constantly growing. Scientists are not sure why it happens or how to cure it. A Facebook group set up by the smell loss charity Absent has already got more than 6,000 members. Nearly all of these people started with anosmia arising from COVID-19 and ended up with parosmia. We spoke to Reading University flavor scientist Dr. Jane Parker, who is undertaking in-depth research on COVID-19 and parosmia. Dr. Parker, what do scientists know so far about the link between COVID-19 and the loss of smell?
Loss of sense of smell post-viral, that is, after viral infections, were known before COVID arrived on the scene. So it's quite well known that loss of sense of smell can be triggered by certain infections, such as sinus infection, flu, and the common cold. And there are people who lost their sense of smell years ago as a result of one of these viruses. The fact that it's associated with COVID-19 is not, with hindsight, surprising. But it was a long time before scientists realised what the link was. And I think initially, when the cases were in China and Iran, people were reporting headaches, fevers, etc. And there were very few reporting loss of sense of smell. But I became aware of it when an ENT doctor put up a tweet or something on social media that says, you know, I've seen more and more people losing their sense of smell, and I've been diagnosed with COVID, and I've got lost my sense of smell. So I know that this is real. And from that point, really, we started looking at, or many, many people around the world started looking at how close this link was. Initially, it was anecdotal, but we gathered more and more evidence to suggest that more and more people were losing their sense of smell with COVID. And the important thing is that it's a sudden onset of loss of sense of smell. So it happens instantaneously. It's not a slow decline. It's a sort of one day breakfast, you're fine, and lunchtime, you've lost your sense of smell. It's instant. And then we've gathered a lot of data. Various groups have shown that somewhere between 50 and 60% of people lose their sense of smell with COVID. So it's certainly one of the key symptoms.
That's quite a lot of people, 50 to 60%. That sounds like one of the major symptoms.
It's huge. And when you think of the number of people around the world with COVID, it does come out to millions of people losing their sense of smell. It's an important symptom, and it's an important ongoing symptom. What we know is that about 90% of those people will probably get their sense of smell back. And I know that from my son, who lost his sense of smell 10 days later. It was back, and it comes back almost as quickly as you lose it. But it's those 10 to 20% for whom it doesn't come back quickly that there's a severe long-term problem. And some of the early problems with recovery is that you develop parosmia, and parosmia is when your sense of smell becomes altered and disgusting. So things that are familiar, everyday smells, smell of sewage or smoke or rotting sewage, or, you know, all sorts of really quite nasty aromas. Nobody can quite tell you what it is they smell like, because from what we can gather, people with parosmia can't describe these aromas because they are so different to anything that they've smelled before. So most people describe them as disgusting, awful, revolting, and use words that describe the emotion attached to them rather than what they actually smell of. So, and this happens typically 3 months into, 2 to 3 months after the onset of anosmia. Now, anosmia is what we call loss of smell. And it's usually a good sign in that it does indicate that things are starting to get better and your sense of smell is recovering. But it's not good news in the fact that it is quite more debilitating. It is more debilitating than simply losing your sense of smell. Losing your sense of smell is worrying in itself, because you can't smell smoke, you can't smell danger, you can't smell gas, you can't smell your loved ones, and it's frustrating, and obviously your food doesn't have any much flavour. You can still taste some things, so you can still taste sweet, salty, sour and bitter, but it has no character, because there's nothing telling you whether you've got a pear or an apple. You really can't distinguish foods, and you no longer enjoy food. When you've got parosmia, it's worse than that. It's one step worse, because the food that you do eat smells revolting. And one of the key triggers is coffee. Many people describe coffee as vomity, sickly sweet, smoky, chemical. And for some people, they can go into a room and smell the coffee at the other end of the room. They can walk past a coffee shop, and in some cases it can be quite severe. In some cases, people really get the urge to be sick. It's nauseating smell. You know, they have to leave the room as quickly as possible. So it is really debilitating for some people who, and imagine if you can't be in the same room as cooking smells, going to restaurants, eating out, all these sort of things become difficult, and many people get quite antisocial, eat on their own, eat what they can. There's a two-way relationship, really, between olfaction and loss of olfaction, or loss of your sense of smell, and depression. We know that if you're clinically depressed, you're prone to losing your sense of smell, or not losing it, but prone to a decrease in your ability to smell. And the reverse is true, that if you've lost your sense of smell, you are prone to depression. So for the people with parosmia, you know, it's a lot worse. And we've had people sending us emails saying, you know, I'd far rather have had anosmia. Anosmia was bad, but this is even worse. I want to go back to smelling nothing at all. And then I suppose if we go on to the recovery, for many people it's really bad in the first few days, weeks, months, but it does tail off a bit. And people do get used to it to a certain extent. Sometimes different things become rather nasty and disgusting. So perhaps to begin with, coffee and chocolate and peanuts were horrible. But I've heard people saying, well, they're better now, but other things like shower gel are the things that sort of set off my parosmia. But within these fluctuations, things do start to get better. But this takes time. From what we know pre-COVID, it can take 3-4 years before you get back to enjoying food. With post-COVID, we don't know how long it takes because obviously people are only just sort of reporting it. There's a 3-month lag anyway from cases, and it is a long-term recovery process. But what's encouraging is the fact that we have had people emailing us saying, you know, I did have this. I didn't know what it was at the time. Nobody believed me. And it is better now. Thankfully, I'm back to normal. I can enjoy food. And so that's within a year. So that's good news that some people are recovering more quickly. We haven't studied people over the years, so it's something we don't know how long recovery will take on average from the post-COVID version.
We hear a lot about comorbidities and having a higher risk of having really bad symptoms from COVID-19. Is there any evidence to suggest that some people might be more prone to getting parosmia and other loss of smell related issues connected to COVID-19?
I don't think we know enough about that. I don't think we can answer that. We do know that younger people tend to be more affected by the smell loss. And to begin with, we thought that was possibly just because the people that were more seriously affected didn't bother reporting it. You know, if you're in hospital and hooked up to all sorts of things, you don't notice whether you can taste or not. But I think subsequently, it has been shown that certainly younger people are more prone to losing their sense of smell. And certainly, from some of the research I've done, the people that are coming through on average into my lab for my study are younger post-COVID than the group that came through before COVID. So before COVID, the average age of people losing their sense of smell, developing parosmia and coming to my study was about 55, whereas with the post-COVID people, the average age is 37. So it does seem to be younger people that are losing their sense of smell.
You said that it's hard to cure this. Are there any treatments to stop the symptoms from developing?
People have tried all sorts of things, but what we tend to recommend is time, because it does take a long time. So time, patience and support, because you really need to prevent yourself spiralling down into sort of clinical depression. So it's really important that you have good support, people that understand you and understand what you're going through. And the third thing is the smell training, where you actually smell essential oils mindfully. So you have to sit and sniff them twice a day, thinking about what they smell like, what they are, what they should smell like. You may not smell them initially, but that doesn't matter. You smell them twice a day for three months at least, and that does help. It has been shown to improve the olfactory function of people that have done smell training compared to those that didn't do it. So that's one very positive thing you can do.
Do scientists have information yet about why COVID might be causing this? What is the sort of the reaction or the chemical activity that happens in the body that is causing this?
There's the two scenarios. There's the short-term scenario where you lose your sense of smell and it comes back after 10 days. We believe that that's to do with the virus in infecting the olfactory epithelium. So that's the bit at the top of your nose where you actually sense all these aromas, where there are neurons that respond to the smells and take the signal up to the brain. And what happens is that the virus attacks the cells in that epithelium. And what they found, interestingly, is that it doesn't actually attack the olfactory neurons, so doesn't attack the nerves that are going to transmit the signal. But what it may do is attack the surrounding cells. These become inflamed. They may sort of, you can imagine they kind of may squash the neurons, they may get in the way. And then the nerves are temporarily out of action. But as soon as the inflammation goes down, perhaps 2 weeks later, the neurons are still there, so you can still smell because they just need to fire up again. And the fact that it comes back so quickly suggests that there's a sort of on-off switch. So once your inflammation's gone, you can smell again because your neurons are there and still healthy. But what happens in the longer term cases is we believe that the inflammation of the other cells, the support cells, is so bad that you end up, there's a sort of knock-on effect and a sort of spillage, if you like, into the olfactory neurons. So they are destroyed as well. And we've got pretty good evidence that the olfactory sensory neurons are destroyed. And what happens, these need to regrow. And regrowing neurons takes quite a long time. but these need to regrow for you to be able to start smelling things again. And the reason that we think you get the parosmia and the bad smells is because when they actually start to regrow, they don't actually attach back onto the same place once they get through the skull and into the olfactory bulb, into the brain. They don't attach onto the same place as they were before, which just sends very mixed messages to our brain that says, I don't know what this smell is. And that might be something to do with why we perceive these smells as disgusting.
I see that some people describe parosmia as a rare side effect of coronavirus, but from what I'm hearing from you, it's not actually that rare. It could be more common than you realise.
No, it's not. And I think people have underestimated how severe it might get, with 50 to 60% of people losing their sense of smell, and 10% of those having long-term, 10 to 20% of those having long-term problems. So already you've got 20% that have lost their sense of smell. And then the parosmia, I reckon maybe 50% of those. I don't think we've got a number on those at the moment, because we're still waiting for people to develop parosmia. It can develop 6 months further down the line. So I don't think we've got hard and fast data for that. But certainly most people, in order to recover, have to go through this parosmic stage once they're beyond the initial 2 weeks. So, or I won't say 2 weeks, because some people take, the short-term people, the average is 2 weeks, but, you know, some might have lost their sense of smell for a month or so, but once you get beyond that into the long-term problem, it's, 12% of cases or something is what's been estimated, and parosmia, maybe half of those.
And before we close off here, perhaps you could just sketch out what's next in research in this field and where your research is going.
So we've been looking at the mechanism, and the way I've come into this as a flavour chemist is unusual in that I spend my time every day looking at what aroma compounds are responsible for the smell in strawberries, the smell in sweet potato fries, the smell in basil, whatever. And the research I'm doing was sparked because I heard a talk at a conference by Chrissy Kelly of Absent, and she had a list of all these foods that triggered parosmia. And as a flavour chemist, I looked at these and thought, these all contain some really potent aroma compounds. And because that's what I'm good at, I'm good at looking for aroma compounds, it was a natural progression. And we started having people through our lab, and we could pick the foods to bits, separate out all the aroma compounds, and we could work out which compounds these people were finding revolting and repulsive. And it turned out that in coffee, for example, about half of the compounds they found were normal, the other half were reported as disgusting and revolting. Now, this makes us, first of all, we now know that it is triggered by specific compounds. But what we need to know in the future is which receptors, which nerves are responsible. I think the research is going towards looking for what we call ligand odoreceptor pairs. So which are the receptors that are responsible for transmitting the signal from the individual aromas? We know it's only some aromas. So we need to find out more about the odoreceptors and what's going on in the epithelium, the bit above the nose where these odours are perceived. Why is it that some are distorted and some aren't? Why is it that some of them cause this real change in hedonic change, and that aromas that are normally pleasant become disgusting? So what is it that triggers that? And that's more likely to be cognitive. That's more likely to be something to do with the central processing system. So that's more neural. That's more to do with the brain. There's a group of people that find, a lot of people that find coffee distorted, and those people tend to find chocolate and peanut butter and fried fries and cooked meat revolting, and they're responding to a certain group of compounds. There's another group that find onions and garlic revolting. Another completely different group that find household products and personal care products revolting. And then water. And that surprised us, really. There is quite a big group of people who find they can't shower, they can't bathe their babies because the smell of the water is just too intense and revolting. And that's the next step of our research, is to looking into what the compounds in water are that might be triggering this reaction.
Inside COVID-19 from BizNews.
As coronavirus vaccines started rolling out late last year, there was a palpable sense of excitement. People began browsing travel websites and airlines grew optimistic about flying again. Ryanair even launched a Jab and Go campaign alongside images of 20-somethings on holiday, drinks in hand. But it's not working out that way. For a start, it isn't clear the vaccines actually stop travellers spreading the disease, even if they're less likely to catch it themselves. Neither are the shots proven against the more infectious mutant strains. This bleak reality has pushed back expectations of any meaningful recovery in global travel to 2022. As Bloomberg reports, that may be too late to save the many airlines with only a few months of cash remaining, and the delay threatens to kill the careers of hundreds of thousands of pilots, flight crew, and airport workers who've already been out of work for close to a year. In this interview, Christopher Nassetta, President and CEO of Hilton, speaks with Bloomberg QuickTake Chief Correspondent Jason Kelly about the outlook for the hotel industry in 2021.
We're going to kick it off right now with a guy who we all want to hear from. I certainly do. Chris Nassetta, the CEO of Hilton. Nice to see you, my friend. A different world we're living in right now.
Yeah, nice to see you. Thanks for having me on. Definitely a different world. Hopefully a world that's on the road to improvement.
Well, I certainly hope so, and I know you do too, for personal sake, for business sake. So let's get into the year ahead. What's the biggest surprise that we're going to see over the next 6 to 12 months?
I think the biggest surprise that we're going to see is the second half of the year is going to be a lot better than everybody thinks. I mean, if you think about sort of the cadence of how this has gone, and certainly our business, we've been on the front lines of this crisis. You know, last April, May, June were devastating in terms of declines in our business. Mobility, you know, around the world went to almost nothing. And what we do requires mobility. So our, you know, our performance was in keeping with that. And then as you got into the summer and into the early fall, things started to, you know, improve, you know, pretty materially from where we were. And then as you got into the winter, as you had resurgence both here in the U.S. and around the world, things started to go backwards, you know, in the fourth quarter and have sort of carried on into the first quarter. And it's tough. And I'd suggest to you the next 60 or 90 days are going to be going to be very difficult. And there are parts of the world that had been doing well that are doing less well. Europe, even Asia Pacific, even China more recently, we've seen it, you know, as you've seen cases increase, you've seen the business drop off in China. And so while I think we're in the middle of the, you know, sort of still in the eye of the storm to a degree, the light is at the end of the tunnel. I mean, I'm an eternal optimist. That's why I chose the industry I'm in, but to a degree, reality is, I think objectively you can see the steps in place. We have a political cycle over with, a new administration, an intense focus on getting us through the crisis in terms of what's going on with the rollout of vaccines. At the same time, you do have, unfortunately, a lot of exposure. And so I think when you look at the data, and I'm not a health expert, but I talk to a lot of them, as you get into the, you know, early spring and certainly later spring, beginning of the summer, you should be at a place where you're not completely through this health crisis. I think it will take a long, long time, but you will be through the epicenter of it in a way where you can sensibly start to see things shift into a very, very different gear. And so, you know, what I've said to our team is, like, the first quarter is going to be really challenging. The second quarter is not going to feel great, but we're going to be transitioning. But I think there's a real opportunity for the third and fourth quarter when we get to the other side of the health crisis to be a lot better than people think. Now, there are the things that need to happen. We need to have, you know, the rollout of the vaccination go well, which, you know, I have confidence in the team that is leading that. We have to have the political system support it. I mean, you have a bunch of things, you know, going on. One is, of course, to get through the crisis. The two is, you know, legislatively making sure that we get the right bills in place to provide a bridge for people who have been impacted, particularly frontline workers, that they get to the other side, liquidity for small business, that they have a bridge so that liquidity issues don't turn into solvency issues. And, you know, that's sort of been done, but needs to continue to be enhanced. And that's obviously being worked on. And then ultimately.
So, Chris, let me, if you don't mind, I want to take those two in two pieces if we can. Let's talk about vaccines and what that rollout looks like from your perspective, because as you said, you have, you know, you have frontline workers in many ways. So how do you think about vaccines when it comes to your own employees and to your guests?
Yeah, listen, I think that things are starting to really pick up from, I mean, we're living in an age where this is a miracle, that these things that would have normally taken 5 or 10 years happened in less than a year. And the idea that we won't have a few bumps and bruises along the way in how we deal with supply chain to roll it out is sort of silly, right? We've never vaccinated the whole country and the whole world like this before. And so I think the administration's getting their act together. Leadership is great. And I think as a result, you're going to see a huge amount of momentum here in the next 60 or 90 days. But it'll take at least that long just in terms of manufacturing capacity catching up. In terms of people getting vaccinated, our team, myself, you know, I've already strongly encouraged everybody on our team, frontline and otherwise, when it's appropriate for them to get vaccinated. I would encourage all of our customers. I would encourage the country and the world to get vaccinated so that we can get to the other side of this.
But not requiring. Will you require it for your employees? How does that work from a corporate perspective?
I don't think we'll require it. I think we are going to strongly encourage it, starting with me when it is appropriate getting it. I will get it. I will make sure our team knows, and I will very strongly encourage all of our team members to get it, and I'll strongly encourage our customers to get it as well, just because I think ultimately getting to the other side of the crisis requires it.
You know, you've been vocal and transparent about what you think the government needs to do from that second bucket that you mentioned, which is legislatively, economically, stimulus-wise. What needs to happen next, especially since there does seem to be, dare I say, a little bit more momentum toward that? Maybe.
Yeah, there is. Listen, I think, as I said, I think there are three pieces. One, we got to get through the crisis, or we don't, you know, we're never going to solve it. The second is doing what I think they are focused on. And the bridge for me is taking care of people, particularly, you know, service level employees, frontline team members that are the most impacted, can least afford to be impacted, to make sure that there's continuation of unemployment insurance that has the top off from the federal government, because it's going to be, listen, we're in the service industry, tremendous number of our team members and millions of folks across our industry are still impacted, and they're going to be impacted for an extended period of time. We have to take care of those folks. And then we have to provide bridges of liquidity, particularly for small and medium-sized businesses. I look at our base of owners. It's 80% small businesses that own hotels all over the country, and no fault of their own, they've had a complete shutdown. Now a little bit of business, but not enough to ultimately make payroll, to make debt service, to pay their taxes, insurance, and all those fun things that are required, or you lose your asset. If they lose their asset, we're just that much longer to where they can get back on their feet and reemploy people. So I think you have to, if this is ultimately about getting to the other side so people can get reemployed and you can get the economy jump-started, you have to make sure that small and medium-sized businesses are in a position to accept those team members back when we get to the other side. And the thing that hasn't gotten any attention yet, and for good reason, honestly, Jason, you know, I said this to the last administration, and I've been talking to this one, is when you do get through the health side of it and hopefully providing the bridges of liquidity, which is what they're focused on with unemployment insurance continuation and the package that's on the Hill and PPP top up, I think they're focused on the right things. Then we have to think about stimulus in the traditional way. I think about stimulus. How do you stimulate the economy, not bridge it, not take care of people out of work? How do you get people back to work? So there's specific things, you know, in our industry, how do you get people once we think they can do it in a safe way, how do you provide incentives to get them traveling again, to go to restaurants again, to congregate again, safely? There'll be a new normal on how they do it. But once we get, you know, through the vaccination process and we all feel comfortable that we can do it in a safe way, we've got to jumpstart the system, because here's the thing, like, as much as everybody wants to get out, you know, this hasn't been a week or two or three. This has been a year, and it's going to have been a year plus. And so you just get in new routines. Like, you know, you and I were talking about our new routines. Like, we don't wear a suit and tie as much as, you know, like, everybody gets in these routines, and you sort of like got to, it's like getting bucked off a horse, I say to our team. You got to, you got to get people back on the horse. And so there's going to have to be, I think, some real stimulus that, you know, that, that incents people. And in the case of our business or food, you know, restaurants and bars, like, that gives incentives, tax incentives and other sort of incentives, so that, that people, you know, will start to get going again. And that part, and we're, so not, you know, is we're not the, even really talking about yet.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, is this something that you're, that you are actively talking about? When does, when do those discussions start happen on film?
Well, listen, I'm not, the last thing I'm going to do is be critical of this administration. They're a week into it, and they've been crushing it. You know, they've got a lot of, you know, crises, sort of multiple crises going on. So we have been talking to them about it. We talked to the prior administration. In all fairness to both administrations, Jason, it has been time, right? I mean, we're not through the crisis. Like, there's no reason to stimulate people to get moving. The next 60 or 90 days are going to be tough. And so, you know, I think everything has a time and place. And I think the time and place for that, in my opinion, will be as we get into the spring. And we really can see that we go from 1 million people being vaccinated a day in the U.S. to 1.5 million or 2 million. And you have a sight line to having the bulk of the population vaccinated. Then I think we can all responsibly say it makes sense to try and stimulate people to get out. Why would you stimulate people to get out when they're in harm's way? And right now, I think reality is they're still in harm's way. So I think appropriately, it's sort of a spring or summer dialogue. But we've had discussion. I had lots of discussions with the prior administration on this. Lots of good ideas. We've started those discussions with this administration. But to their credit, they're focused on the immediacy of the health crisis, and they're focused on the immediacy of building the bridge to get folks to the other side.
And that brings to a close your Inside COVID-19 podcast. Until next time, I'm Jackie Cameron for BizNews.
This conversation on COVID-19 is made possible by Discovery.